Oh,
well, welcome back, everybody. It is a pleasure to see many of you who decided that, you know, if you made it through the 13 principles, which probably blew your mind, you said, how hard could the alphabet be? That's just the Hebrew alphabet. Well, I'm glad you decided to join me on this journey. We're going to start with a basic idea. It's a simple question. I'm sure you've all thought about it and have come up to it with a very logical conclusion. When God created the universe, how did he do it? Well, you say, I don't know. I wasn't there. But the truth is, some of you who've attended my class in the past know that the answer to that question is through the medium of speech. The Torah tells us in the very first chapter of the Torah that when God was creating the universe, and it repeats the phrase, and God said, let there be light. And God said, let the earth bring forth vegetation. And God said, and God said, and God said, over and over and over again. For whatever the reason, which hopefully at some point we will tackle, the Torah describes the method by which God created the universe was through the medium of language. God spoke. Well, by definition, if a person is speaking, it needs to be a language. Well, a language, by definition, is made up of words. Words are made up of letters. Well, that got our sages thinking. Well, if this is really the case, that God created the universe through the medium of speech, that means there was an alphabet. Because otherwise, how do you make words without letters? So it's not surprising, therefore, that we are told by our sages that the letters of the alphabet, the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, were created before the creation of our universe. You say, but how's that possible? Well, what if I told you it's the very first creation? You say, but how's that possible? I don't know. But that is what happened. Well, I'll show you. It's alluded to in the very opening sentence of the Torah. The opening words of the Torah are, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. In the beginning of God creating the heavens and the earth was astonishingly empty, etc., 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 and God said, let there be light. But that opening phrase, in the beginning of God creating the heavens and the earth, in the Hebrew, it's a very funny expression because it says, Bereshit, in the beginning, bara Elokim, God created, and then comes this word that has no good English translation, et hashamayim. The word hashamayim by itself means the heavens. So what's et hashamayim? It's still translated as the heavens. Ve'et haaretz. Well, haaretz means the earth. Ve'haaretz means and the earth. So what's ve'et haaretz? So here the classic work of mysticism, the book of Kabbalah known as the Zohar. The Zohar suggests that on a deeper level, the way perhaps to read and understand the verse is not the way I read it to you originally, of where the comma, when I read it to you, when I said it to you, is Bereshit bara Elokim, comma, et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, when God, in the beginning of God creating, comma, the heavens and the earth. The Zohar suggests that on a deeper level, the comma goes after the word et, and it means Bereshit bara Elokim et, comma. In the beginning, when God was creating, you know what he created? The word et. Now, the word et is an interesting word. In Hebrew, it's made up of two letters. It's comprised of the letter Aleph and the letter Tav. Well, Aleph and Tav are representative of the first and last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. If somebody says in English, oh, I covered the material from A to Z, well, in Hebrew, we say, I covered it from Aleph to Tav, in completion. And therefore, the Zohar suggests that Bereshit bara Elokim et, the very first creation that God made was the alphabet, Aleph through Tav, from which he created Hashamayim ve'et haaretz, the heavens and the earth. What does that mean? Let's try to understand what can this possibly mean. If you know what the concept of protoplasm is the raw materials from which you create something else. Imagine for a moment that these letters aren't just letters that have a sound or even just a shape. Rather, what they are primal spiritual forces, the raw material of creation. When you combine different energies, you create different things. We know this. Anyone who's ever studied chemistry knows that you take various atoms, various molecules of various elements, and you put them to create, you put them together to create something. For example, two atoms worth of hydrogen and one of oxygen is known as H2O. You get water. That is the chemical compound known as water. So H, hydrogen, represents a certain energy, a certain force in the world. And oxygen is a different element, a different force. And when you combine them in a certain order, in a certain formula, you create something. In this particular case, it's water. But if you change the permutations, and instead of it being H2O, you do HO2, one of hydrogen, two of oxygen, you do not have water anymore. You have something else. What? I have no idea. But it ain't water. The point here is that every single letter in the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, isn't just a letter that's a convention for us to communicate. It actually has representation of a spiritual energy from which the entire universe, which contains everything, was made. Where do we see this brought out even more? God creates Adam and Eve, puts them in a Garden of Eden. You know that story very well. But what you may not have remembered from your Hebrew school days is that the very first challenge for Adam and Eve, the first exercise, their wisdom, was God brought before them every single creature and asks Adam to name the creature. Name. What, Adam? What are you going to name this creature? Which in English, let's say, we call cat. Well, Adam looked at it and he said, that's called a chatul. That's the Hebrew word for cat. And then he brought before him what we would call a dog. And Adam said, oh, that's a kelev. And every single creature that was brought before Adam, he gave it a name. Now, I don't know about you, but what's the big deal? So he gave it a name. How does this show any kind of mastery? In fact, the Midrash tells us that the angels were upset with God. They were upset, like, what is it that you see about man that you don't have with us already? What is it that man has as an advantage? And God said, look at his wisdom. And they said, what wisdom? And then you have the story of him naming the animals. How is that a display of wisdom? The fact that he called this a hippopotamus and this an elephant, whoop-de-doo. What's that got to do with anything? What our sages teach us is that God came to Adam and Eve and said, listen, if you're going to be the custodians of this universe, mankind is in charge of everything, then you better know all of the creatures and know specifically what their essence is. What makes a cat different than a dog? And when you name it, you should identify those unique aspects of each creature. That takes tremendous wisdom. He asked Adam to demonstrate that spiritual insight into each and every creature. Can you see what makes it special? Can you see what makes it different? I'll give you two examples. I may have shared this with you in the past. The leader in Egypt, the one who enslaved the Jewish people, he was known as Pharaoh. Whether that was his proper name or that's just for any of the leaders of Egypt, that's for up for another discussion. But the one that the Torah identifies, his name is Paro. In Hebrew, it's spelled with four Hebrew letters. A pe, a resh, an ayin, and a hey. What was he all about? Well, Paro, our sages teach us, was evil at his core. He was an evil person, corrupt and out to destroy. But you can't, it's very hard for a leader to get up there and say, we need to destroy people, because people, most people have a good side to them. So how did Pharaoh do it? Our sages tell us that he was an extremely talented orator. He spoke beautifully and he was captivating and he was able to capture the people. Our sages tell us that the name Pharaoh is representative of that, because the two middle letters of his name, Resh and Ayin, spell the word ra, which means evil in Hebrew. But the outer two letters, the pei and the hey, spell the word peh, which is mouth. He was able to couch his evilness with his mouth. That is the definition. So what I'm telling you is that each letter in the alphabet represents a certain energy, and in a certain combination, in a certain word, it defines the essence of that thing, whether it's a person, an animal, or an object. The letters are what in fact is creating and defining what that thing is. It's not for no reason that there is a law that we're supposed to be reviewing the weekly Torah portion before every Shabbat. I don't mean all of them every Shabbat. I mean that week's. Yeah, I'm going to get 13 emails clarifying that now. Right. What I mean is that this week's Parsha is Bahalotcha. One should be going over that Parsha twice of the text itself and one translation to make sure you understand. The question was raised. Okay, I understand if it's a matter of law, if it's a matter of understanding a story, but if it's just the name of a city or it's the name of a person, why is that so critical that I need to repeat that weekly portion and its translation? If it's just the name of a place, who cares? It's just the name of a person. Just give me the gist, Rabbi. The answer is because it contains the inner meaning, the hidden mystery regarding the name of that place. Those of you who we were fortunate before Corona hit, we were able to study about some of the cities or mountains in Israel. What we did is we studied the name of that mountain and understood what its historical context was. Because the name of something isn't just a convention that we come up what to differentiate it from something else, but rather it's a defining item. It is defining its essential nature. It also would explain why we're so careful that we have to articulate our prayers or when we're studying Torah to do it out loud. God knows what I'm saying. God, why do I have to verbalize it? As long as I think it's good enough. No. The answer is because the letters and the word combinations have the power. Because each one has a spiritual energy that has the power to arouse those spiritual forces beyond what we can view or perceive. There's so much involved when it comes to the letters. I'll give you another example. If you want to think about it this way, there are 22 Hebrew letters. The 22 primary Hebrew letters you can compare to a seed prior to its planting. What is that seed? That seed is basically a microcosm that contains all of the forces and energies of everything that's created from there. Just as the seed contains the elements for the root, and the root contain all of the branches, so too everything that was to become expressed in the physical terms of our universe was already contained within the alphabet. They are the 22 seeds that combine their energies to create our universe. The eternal nature or the metaphysical nature of our alphabet, of our Hebrew language, is expressed so beautifully in two particular incidents that I think you can all relate to. We're all familiar with the story, unfortunately, with the sin of the golden calf. Moses goes up the mountain at Mount Sinai to go receive the hard copy of the Torah that was expressed verbally by God. He's up there 40 days and 40 nights. When he comes down, he's expecting the Jewish people to celebrate this incredibly historic moment. And unfortunately, instead, they are reveling around the calf. So what does Moses do? He takes those two stone tablets and he smashes them to bits. Okay, it's destroyed. What's destroyed? I would expect you to say the stone tablets, the lettering that was engraved on it, and that's the end of that. However, again, the Zohar tells us that while the stone was shattered, the letters themselves flew heavenward. The letters flew, and I understand, if the letters are only a part of the tablets and ingrained only in a physical sense, then how were they separated from the tablets themselves? The answer is that yes, the stone tablets were physical in nature. But the energy, the metaphysical letters, they're not subject to destruction because they're not only physical. They're beyond that. And you can't destroy that which is not physical. Therefore, the shattering of the Luchos, the shattering of those tablets, were just the tablets. The stone was destroyed, but the letters themselves are eternal. Similarly, we're familiar with the fact that there are a few people, few biblical personalities, whose names are changed over the course of their lifetime. For example, you have Avram and Sarai become Avraham and Sarah. Well, you say, okay, that's just a cool thing. You change their names. Well, what changed about them? Well, the insertion of a letter into a person's name or replacing it for another, again, if you swap out hydrogen and you put in something else, it's an entirely different creation. It's no longer the same combination, and therefore the element is completely different. It's an altered state of existence now. Avram and Sarai, in their former state, were not destined to have children. But God changed their names. To Avraham, he added the letter He, and to Sarai, he swapped the Yud for a He, and becomes Sarah. Now they are completely different people. Not just, oh, that's cute. Now they go by another name. It's a pseudonym or a nickname. No. You've changed the permutations, you've changed the lettering, you've thereby changed the entire spiritual energy of the person. And this is really the basis of what we're going to try and cover and try to understand. Let me throw another one at you. I said to you that there are 22 primary letters in the Hebrew alphabet from Aleph to Tav. But those of you who know the Hebrew language a little bit better know that there's also, in addition to those 22, there are 5 final letters. Meaning these are the same letter that if it appears at the end of a word, then it's the same pronunciation, but it has a different form, a different shape. They're called final letters. They are the Mem, the Nun, the Tzadi, the Pei, and the Kaf. Or Chaf. They each have a final form. There are 5 of them. So in essence, you really have, if you really want to be technical, there are 27 Hebrew letters. There's 22 primary plus 5 that are secondary in the sense that they are primary letters, but only at the end take on a different form. How many vowels? Here's something interesting. In English, letters are also vowels, but not in Hebrew. In Hebrew, letters are letters and vowels are another symbol that are the sound to be given. That when in conjunction with the letter is how you know how to pronounce the letter. How many vowels are there? There are 10. For those of you not taking the Hebrew reading course, you can breathe a sigh of relief. You don't have to know all of them right now. It will be on the final, however. So the 22 primary letters, plus the 5 final letters, now you're at 27. And there are, each letter can have one of 10 vowels. Hence, you have a total of 270 possible letters with vowels, letter sounds. For those who took old school Hebrew and they made you look at the letter and do all the vowels, you would do a, a, e, u, right? Yeah, well, each letter you got to do that for. Hence, you have 270 possible letter sound combinations. It's not a coincidence that when you go ahead and you use your speech inappropriately, for example, you speak Lashon Hara, you speak gossip, you speak negatively of someone else, you pollute the world. You know what is the numerical value of the word evil, ra? Yeah, 270. Resh Ayin. Every letter in the Hebrew alphabet, besides being a letter, also has a structure, has a sound, and has a numerical value. So when you put it in totality, when you use and misuse, I should say, when you misuse your power of speech, you are corrupting 270 possible sounds using the letters, hence the word ra, as in Lashon Hara. However, when you speak positively, you also create friendships with people. When you use your words to comfort somebody, to give them inspiration, to teach them something, and you use your words carefully to encourage and promote friendship, it also is 270. But instead of pronouncing it as ra, evil, it's rea. Rea means a friend. Yeah, it's also 270. The key here is how do you use the letters? Because the spiritual energies, it's no different than an atom. A-T-O-M, sorry, friend. An atom can be harnessed for positive things by creating, or it can be broken down into its very, very pristine form and create a bomb. It's all how you harness the power of the energy. These are our letters that have spiritual energies. But let's take it a little bit further. Biblical, when I refer to Hebrew, I'm not talking necessarily about modern Hebrew. I'm talking about biblical Hebrew, the Torah's letters. The Torah's language is the only language in the world where the letters have philosophical meanings, not just shapes and sounds. For example, let's talk about cat. There is no intrinsic meaning to the letter C. It doesn't mean anything. The letter T, I mean, I personally think it means a lot, but generally, T has no meaning by itself, nor does the letter A unless it's being used as a word. There's no intrinsic meaning to the letters C or A or T. It only gets meaning when you put them together and it spells a word that we agreed represents this creature called a cat. From a Torah perspective, the Hebrew language is not only, you have a word, it's not only a dictionary definition, but rather every word comprised of those letters is the sum total of the meaning of those letters in that particular order. The letters for cat in Hebrew, chet, tav, vav, lamed, chatul, they are the spiritual energies that are describing what a cat is. What's it? How do you know that? How are we going to put this all together? Well, this is only the undergraduate course. You'll have to stick around for the master's and the doctorate. Stick around. Okay? Only the Torah's language can be broken down and analyze it letter by letter of what each letter's energy represents. It's only the Torah's language. Those of you who took the previous course on Maimonides' 13 principles, this shouldn't come to you as a shock. Because again, what is the Torah? The Torah is the articulated expression of God's will. Sure, if God is eternal and God is infinite and God is every omni I can think of, then his will as expressed in a language is not one-dimensional. Every single part of it has meaning. And therefore, to go ahead and to analyze every single letter is exactly what we need to do to understand. Just like human beings use letters and combinations to express the product of their will and their intelligence, God did the same thing, articulating his will in creation through the Torah. Therefore, the more you study it, the more you learn it, the more you engage with Torah, the more you're merging with that divine mind, with that divine understanding of our world and our universe. The Aleph Bet, if you want to put it in simple terms, the Aleph Bet are the brick and mortar or the soul of our universe. That's the infrastructure. Everything that happens in our world, everything that it's based on, is based on these bricks, based on the soul. The same could be true for people. The same could be said for us as a nation. When you look at the word Yisrael, Yisrael meaning the Jewish people, again, Yisrael could be understood as an acronym for Yesh Shishim Ribu Otiot LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah. Yeah. Every single person has their unique letter in the Torah. Why? Because every letter has a certain spiritual energy. And yes, Fran, it has multiple understandings, and therefore multiple people can share a letter in that regard. Reference back to the previous, okay? But what it does mean, though, is an understanding that every single bit of us, both as a person, as a nation, and as a universe, has at its core a spiritual energy. When your Hebrew name is given to you, you are infused with a certain spiritual energy. You may not like your name, but it defines who you are. The letters, you may not like the way it sounds, and you may not like and you wish to add something else, but it is your spiritual energy, your talents, your abilities, your strengths, and your weaknesses. It is who you are. Therefore, this class is our job to try now to examine these seeds, to look at their form, look at their structure, their shape, the sound that they make, the numerical value that's ascribed to them, and how they interact with other seeds to then make words, which then give us insights about everything around us. The goal of this class, I will be brutally honest, is to have a much deeper appreciation about our Torah. That's the end game here. It's not just learn the letters. The end game here is that you will learn, hopefully, that these letters are the building blocks of everything in Judaism. Because it, for me to go ahead and say a word, and I know some of you love when I break down the word and show you its root and what, where am I getting this from? I'm getting it from this concept. We're going back to the beginning. We're going back to basics. What does an aleph represent? What does it mean? Why does it make a sound or not make a sound? My goal is for us to learn. We are not going to be able by the end of this class to then do black magic, put letters together and presto changeo to start doing things. That's way above my pay grade. But if nothing else, my hope is that we will go through the letters, understand some aspects of them, appreciate the depth that they have, and thereby have a greater appreciation that when we see a Hebrew word in the Torah, we should ask, what is the root of that word? What does it intrinsically mean? And if it means what I think it does, then why does it fit in this context or not? That's where we want to go with all of this. We are going to examine seeds, 22 of them, I hope, God willing, plus maybe if we really get bold and we get it, we'll study the five, which have a whole different understanding. That's my objective for this class. God willing, tomorrow night, we will start with the letter Aleph, and I am going to try and keep it to 30 minutes. That's my goal. I gave up on the 15 to 20. It's a blessing in vain. It's not happening. So I'm going to shoot for the 30 minutes and try to stick to it. Any questions of what we've said as an introduction? Great. Excellent. What?
I have a question.
Yes, Jacob.
So you said that our names are like our essences. So like if someone were to decide to change their own name, would their essence change in the same way that like Avram and Sarai's names were changed and then their essences changed?
You're assuming that you know that the change is for a positive. How do you know you're going in the right direction?
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying like, will their essence change at all?
Yes. The answer is yes. I'll give you a very practical halachic answer to that. God forbid, we should never know from it. Somebody who is deathly ill, and I'm not talking about someone who's just, I'm talking about somebody who is literally hanging on by a thread. There is a concept that we've tried everything medically. We are without options. There is a halachic basis of something called shinui shem, changing the person's name. It's a last resort. The concept is that if you either add a name, and typically you'll add a name that has a connotation of life to it. So often if it's a man, they may add the name Rafael, which means healing, or they'll add the name Chaim, which means life. For a lady, they may add the word Chaya, The name Chaya also represents life. What is just that? It's a magic trick? No, because when you are adding that name, you are literally changing that person. And if they had a decree, God forbid, a decree that that other person was to die, well, that person doesn't exist. The person you see in the bed is no longer that person. Yeah, you've changed their essence. I'm oversimplifying it. I don't want anyone to start doing this every Monday and Thursday. But there is such a concept. Yeah, changing a name is changing an essence. Even just changing a letter changes the essence. Without waxing philosophical, that's part of Maimonides' premise for what happens when a person repents and a person does teshuva. How does it work? Logically, it makes no sense. I'm still the same person. Why? Because now I feel bad. I'm sorry. I regret it. But I did it. How do I undo what's did? You know, sometimes you're working on a program on the computer and sometimes it lets you hit undo. And sometimes you pull your hair out when it doesn't let you. And you're like, but how do I undo this? Teshuva logically makes no sense. So the Rambam Maimonides says part of the process is that when you go ahead and you repent, you've actually changed yourself. You're no longer that other person who did that sin. You're a completely different creature now. It's not a name change, but it's your essence that's changed. And you're not working with the same spiritual energies you were prior to repenting.
Thank you.
All right, are we good? All right, we'll see you guys tomorrow night.
Thank you.
8 o'clock.
Good night, everybody.
8 o'clock. Yeah.